one of the leaders of the organization said, all of us volunteer. Like, nobody's getting paid to be here. And this woman was like, really? Like, she just couldn't imagine that we would have this kind of work and nobody got paid to do it. That was a turning point for me. What it felt like to be able to say, I don't get paid to organize with this organization. And all of us are on the same page. None of us are getting paid to do this work. And we all are carving out time to meet and to plan and to organize and to do phone calls. That there was something about that that felt so good.
They come from the funding structures that the things that started as the grassroots movement get funding from the government, and then it has to follow certain government positions. Obviously, we can't really rely on the state to be working in the interest of people who are being abused in the Muslim situation, etc., because of the sexism, because of all the other things that happen in the state.
The book goes a lot more into detail about what it means to even have private foundations whose wealth would otherwise be taxed and go into a public sector that we would then see being accountable to people, instead being housed in nonprofit structures that then kind of privatize what would otherwise be public money.
The book Amara Perez is speaking of, The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, is out now on South End Press. The United States nonprofit sector is the world's seventh largest economy. Over 1.5 million organizations of staggering diversity share the tax-exempt 501c3 designation, including many social justice organizations. Some of these organizations find themselves blunting political goals to satisfy government and foundation mandates. But even as funding shrinks and government surveillance rises, many activists find it difficult to imagine movement building outside the nonprofit model. The Revolution Will Not Be Funded gathers original essays by radical activists from around the globe who are critically rethinking the long-term consequences of this investment. Tonight on Circle A Radio, we speak with Amara Perez and Emmy Koyama, both contributors to the book and both speaking at In Other Words Bookstore on Monday, August 20th, as a fundraiser for Sisters in Action for Power. Stay tuned.
My name is Amara Perez. I am currently the program director at In Other Words Bookstore and Resources. I'm also the former executive director of Sisters in Action for Power, and which is a community-based organization here in Portland that is dedicated to developing the critical thinking, leadership, and organizing skills of girls in middle and high school, and just transitioned out of the organization after 11 years. So I identify as a community organizer and definitely committed to social justice work and community building. And I've also been the co-founder and co-chair of an organization called Happy Hours, Hours spelled O-U-R-S, which is a community group that organizes lesbian women of color in Portland. I've been doing that for about 8 years. I came into organizing through an internship program from an organization based in Oakland, California, the Center for Third World Organizing, who has a kind of a training program for young people of color to teach the basics organizing skills, and did that internship in 1996 and was placed here in Portland when the organization was about a year old. So it was a 3-month internship, and then afterwards I was hired on as the kind of first staff organizer. My experience I brought had been working with girls doing leadership development, but not in a social justice context. So my role was to build a leadership program that would support the development of young women as organizers and in the context of social justice, that would develop a wide variety of skills that would be both related to building the organization, running issue campaigns, and developing critical analysis and strategizing skills to kind of drive both. So after 3 years, I became the director of the organization, and 3 months later, after some tension between us and the parent organization, we split. And I found myself in the position of really facing the nonprofit agency piece of the work that we had been doing. So most of my work had been the community organizing and leadership development work, and didn't really have a sense of what the other pieces were because I was an organizer for the organization. So when we split, we, you know, very quickly had to assemble ourselves. It was myself and two other staff. All of us were very new to the work and had very little kind of admin, grant writing, agency building skills. All of us had been doing mostly organizing work. So that was my kind of the beginning of my experience, and it was kind of in crisis and definitely a sense of urgency around saving the organization, continuing the organization at a time when it was kind of meant to shut down.
Was this Sisters for Action and Power, or was this a different organization?
It was the same organization. Our original name was Spirit, Sisters in Portland Impacting Real Issues Together. And when we split, we became Sisters in Action for Power. So we split in 1999. That most of the chapter that I wrote for The Revolution Will Not Be Funded really tells that story, what it was like for us to build the organization from that place, a kind of a reflection on the advice that we got from most folks who were in similar organizations, similar structures, similar work, what we found to be the most exhausting and problematic, and really a reflection of, you know, as an organization in many ways who's been successful in our organizing work, and even having transitioned, myself transitioning out and turning over the organization to young women who've grown up in the organization, we have kind of been a model as a success story. And so for us, it's been really important to talk about the contradictions and the challenges of having done that work. Even though in many ways we've been successful, there's been to some cost, you know, and being able to reflect on that. The chapter in the book talks about the ways in which so much of our energy was about fundraising and working with foundations and program officers and writing grants and proposals, all of the kind of administrative things that we had to get in place in order to be legitimate. So everything from copiers and fax machines and letterheads and business cards and, you know, packaging your accomplishments and all the things that any agency would have, and the way in which that kind of became more important in some ways than the organizing work in terms of what we needed to be seen as a viable organization, a fundable organization, and the ways we ended up having to balance that work with organizing work, and how they're very two different skill sets and that demand very two different kinds of expertise, and what happens when we got past that point to, you know, actually had, we were also in the middle of a campaign in which we won about a year later. And then this next wave of pressure to get bigger and expand our base and to hire more staff and to double our budget. And so there's kind of the beginning of the story of assembling this nonprofit organization, and then kind of a little bit out into when we got a lot of national recognition for winning our campaign against TriMet to get free and reduced bus passes for kids. And then this kind of second wave of pressure and navigating through that, you know, all at the same time, our ultimate commitment was about having a very clear political analysis to drive our work, our commitment to building a base of grassroots leaders, of young women who are middle school and high school, of being able to be very strategic and thoughtful in the issue campaigns that we ran, that were fighting for demands that we felt like were winnable but also radical, that also reflected our political analysis. We spent a lot of internal time trying to really articulate that analysis. And for us, it was based on an examination of colonialism and what did it mean for us to do that work, that very kind of evaluative work and internal work that nobody would fund because we couldn't measure the success of that kind of political development. And so for organizations who really dictate the work that they do based on the money they get, what does that mean about the work that we do? And what does it mean for us to seek out money to stay open that doesn't reflect our priorities in the organizations? And what does it mean for us to be competing with organizations most like us for very small pots of money when we're ultimately trying to do movement building work? So all of these challenges, you know, because we really wanted to be mindful of what our original intention was in terms of coming into the work, and yet most of the advice that we got from people had to do around building a 501c3 agency. Nobody asked us, well, are you sure you have a political analysis to guide your work? And be careful you don't get burned out. And, you know, let me just tell you a little bit about this foundation dance you're going to have to do. And here's strategies for getting around it. There was never really anything about that. It was really a push to create an agency to then do your work, whatever that work is. What is different for us is that when I hear people say, oh, we have this great idea, we want to start this social justice group, so we're trying to get our 501c3, I say, why? Why are you getting a 501c3? Why do you want to raise a budget to pay people to do the work? You know, Sisters in Action is not changing its structure. They're not going to not take grants. They're not paying their organizers. But I do think that when I think about my particular work and the organizing work, for me and my experience, while I came into organizing feeling like nonprofits are a great structure to house our work, you know, this is something I can have a career in, I can get paid to do radical work, isn't that amazing? I really think very differently now about it. I don't think it's sustainable. I don't think that there is a never-ending amount of money for us to do social justice work. I don't think it reflects our historical legacy. You know, nonprofit structures are new in terms of our longer movement of resistance and struggle. And I think it actually comes with a very, you know, significant cost that's not just about professionalizing the movement, but replicating structures that we would otherwise say that we are working to change. And I think those contradictions are not being addressed and articulated, and there isn't a movement space for us to say, okay, it's been 40 years since we've been doing the nonprofit thing. Is it working? Are we losing anything? Are we still have our radical edge? Are people still occupying public space in a radical way that, you know, may cost us this? Or are we going to work? Are we going to work every day to do social justice work? And then we're coming home and we're coming back to our communities that are different than where we go to work. So those are, you know, kind of a list of the things that, you know, that we speak about in the chapter of the book that I think the book in general tries to raise, you know, and I think the book goes a lot more into detail about what it means to even have private foundations whose wealth would otherwise be taxed and go into a public sector that we would then see being accountable to people instead being housed in nonprofit structures that then kind of privatize what would otherwise be public money. So I think the book goes much broader. Our particular piece is about, you know, from, you know, our role as organizers on the ground, what it's meant for us. But the book really goes into a lot of other pieces.
My name is Emi Koyama, and right now I'm the director for Intersex Initiative, which is an important Oregon-based national advocacy group for people born with intersex conditions, or disabled sex development, as some people call it today. My real background in activist work comes from working at the Rape Crisis Center and the Domestic Violence Shelter. That's the kind of like where I come from, and that's the where I used to work for a long time. Then realizing that the way that things are set up doesn't really work for anybody. That's the kind of concern that I was writing in my contribution to the Insight anthology.
You're going to be part of that discussion again, a presentation at In Other Words Books on August 20th, which some of us got to see that presentation at CSTI, and you talked with us about seeking funding and funders having power in the domestic violence realm. Could you talk about your experiences with that?
The funding is, you know, isn't something that Insight has been working on. I can't speak for them, but I think that where Insight comes from is like it started out challenging the ways that the mainstream and sexual and domestic violence groups that's working against violence against women were focusing too narrowly on the kind of violence that they would deal with, so that they'll only look at the, if it's a sexual assault or domestic violence, and not really see the larger context of that, you know, how the different forms of violence affects the women of color. So that's where it started from. Then in critiquing the kind of mainstream anti-violence movement, it became obvious that part of the problem really comes from the funding structures, that the things that started as the grassroots movement get funding from the government, and then it has to follow certain government positions. And in domestic violence work, like, for example, the main thing that happens is that the policies around the alcohol and drug use, and especially drug use. Some shelters have more strict policies than others, but the shelter I was working at had a policy of, you know, kicking out anybody who uses drugs or drinks ever. So, for example, somebody went to a Christmas party at the friend's house or something and then came back to the shelter, and people were all suspicious that she must have had some champagne and things like that. So they want to do breath tests to see if she had any alcohol or anything like that. Other example would be, like, they had a drug policy. First, like, they were looking into somebody's eyes to see if they look like they've used drugs. That was really unfair, and eventually they came up with this idea, okay, we can just use the urine analysis. So what they do is they'll follow a woman to restroom to, like, watch her pee into a little cup so you can test her urine. And this is happening at the Mexican shelter. It just seems really invasive and the kind of controlling behavior that you think is something that people are escaping from in the first place. Much of that has to do with the fact that they're getting government money for it, and sometimes private foundations that really want to have like positions around and things that are not really realistic.
What are some of the strategies for dealing with that?
I feel really contradicted, because in one way, those services should be provided by the state through the tax system and not through the system where the people can, rich people can save their taxes by, you know, not pay taxes by making private donations to the foundation, but without any kind of a democratic control over it or oversight over it. So ideally, those services should be provided by the state under the, you know, oversight of the people. But obviously, we can't really completely rely on the state to be working in the interest of people who are being abused in the Venezuelan situation, etc., because of the sexism, because of all the other things that happen in the state. So I think that part of the problem is that we got into this shelter model of fighting against domestic violence, especially, you know, when you talk about domestic violence. It's a huge industry. It employs like 1,000 people, probably more, around the country. And it created this kind of bureaucracy that's run by people who have the degrees in social work or psychology or whatever they have. And they're creating kind of bureaucracy. And the reason there's bureaucracy in the first place is really because of the funding again. We have the system that requires record keeping and making sure that things are run by the regulations. And sometimes those regulations get because it's like people, but much of that is like producing paperwork, and that requires lots of bureaucracy. And also, because the state or foundations has to evaluate which organization deserves money more than others, when they do, they rely on like what kind of degrees people have, what kind of training they have, so that it really removes away from the grassroots movement. And one thing that they really found it worked is that providing legal representation for divorce and child custody, and obviously that's a major concern if somebody wants to leave a violent situation, there's a mismatch between what actually helps reduce violence versus the kinds of things that the society is likely to provide. Shelter system, as I said, is not only it replicates the kind of abusive pattern power and control that we're trying to fight in the first place, but also that it's extremely expensive, not just the running the shelter itself, but running the bureaucracy that is required to get money to run the shelters in the first place. Really, we really need to look for, you know, other ways of doing this, and especially more preventative measures through education in society that seeks to prevent the violence rather than, you know, the housing people, not just the victims, but when they send the offenders to the prisons, but also housing people, really expensive. It doesn't work. People just come back quickly, and then they'll, you know, reoffend again and things like that.
Are there models in which people who have gone through domestic violence situations are now the ones in control and finding the solutions?
It's very difficult. The problem is that we don't have the kind of community where, you know, everybody knows each other, and everybody, you know, people are stuck there. People have to live together. Traditionally, that's been the case. In some of the communities, such as certain immigrant communities, certain ethnic communities that speak languages in English, tend to have to stay together And because of that, different ways that people can deal with it, that people can hold abusers accountable, or not even they call them abusers, but like really trying to resolve the problem that may happen. And we don't have that kind of a community in a greater society. So it's very difficult that any innovative project, if somebody comes up with a great idea that can address violence in the community, the foundations will fund it, and then it will get bureaucratized the same way. So because we can't see the possibility of expanding our movement other than going through this kind of foundation grants and 501c3 status, because we can't see any other possibility, it's really difficult. We just get taught that when you have a successful startup nonprofit, people will tell you that, oh, when are you going to get 501c3? And then people will say, oh, you can get money from this organization, this foundation, and this government grant, and get sucked into this system. It's no longer as innovative. It becomes just another bureaucracy. In the intersex work that I've done, I was actually an intern at the Intersex Society of North America, which sort of started the intersex movement in the U.S. I was an intern there when the organization was turning from the private organization to a 501c3 nonprofit. And I can see that not only that, how that process made the activist work really boring and less exciting. It also got some money to run the organization, which was good because at the time that it was an only organization. So because of the experience that when I got my own organization doing intersex advocacy in Portland, I mean, just totally avoided the system. I tried to just raise a fund myself or small donations or selling the materials that we produce and then not go through any 501c3 or any foundation grant. Because I saw how the activism became all about doing the paperwork as opposed to doing the actual work, which getting people or the challenges, the certain structures.
Could you, for our listeners, explain a little bit about what your organization does? You do so much work on the internet, and you have an awesome website.
The organization that I run, Intersex Initiative, is advocacy for people who are born with an intersex condition and disorders of sex development. There's so many different ways that people can be sexed, in the chromosomal level to gonads or testes, ovaries, to the external physical characteristics, to secondary sex characteristics and how they develop and things like that. So that when that strays away from any time, like what is considered standard males and females, may mean that subtle and nobody would notice it except that person, or it could be just a little line on the medical chart, or it could be something really noticeable. So what I'm trying to do is to change the kind of ways that the medicine that treats it is really extremely abnormal and horrifying thing into something that can be accepted and that people can learn about themselves and take care of themselves and things like that, and to, you know, spread information around that. So that's the kind of work that I do. Much of that is on the internet because, as I said, I don't have the funding to do other things. So just trying to put the more information and the news, and if there's a new medical paper that talks about intersex but doesn't do it right, then we try to write critiques of it. So that's the kind of things I do. I do get calls from people who have had the child diagnosed with some sort of intersex condition. Nobody gets diagnosed as intersex because that's not a condition. That's like a label for so many different conditions. But when somebody is diagnosed with a condition that could be related to intersex, that, or some child is diagnosed, and their parent might sometimes call us and find out what to do, who to talk to, and things like that. That's the main work that I do. Outside of that, on my personal website, which is feminism.org, like feminism, except there's no F, try to do the different kind of things. Doing, you know, have lots of anti-racism things, some of the trans issues, some of the disability and activism and theory, all the things that I put out there. Many of the articles that's been published in different journals and different magazines and books are also on the website.
People can actually download posters on your website. They can purchase buttons. Is that correct? They can purchase some of the different things to support.
That's one of the main fundraisers for my organization, or how I fund my activism, is making all those quiver buttons, trying to sell them at different places.
I noticed you had a poster that was commenting on the use of the word lame, and it's been something that I, as a person whose father is lame, he has a leg that he was born with a birth defect, to hear people using that word in a negative sense all over the place is really hurtful for a lot of people. But you had a concept on your website about reclaiming that word in a positive way. Can you talk about that?
It really doesn't come from me. There's a history of reclaiming words like lame and gimp and disability activism. I made a button that says lame is good. Somebody wanted a button that said lame is sexy, so I changed that one also. It's not really original to me, but I'm actually producing the kind of posters that people can download and print out and put it out somewhere.
That was Emmy Koyama. Her website is eminism.org. eminism.org. And again, this is Amara Perez.
How a grant works is that, you know, you get what they call an RFP, or request for proposal. And it basically says, here's what, you know, the Ms. Foundation or the Ford Foundation wants to fund. And it's a description of the particular program. You would write a letter of intent. It's an initial letter that says, here's a summary of what our program is. They then send you saying a letter saying, yes, send us a full proposal, or no, thank you, don't bother. When they say yes, then you have a full proposal, which can be anywhere from 15 to 20 pages, where you answer a wide variety of questions, from what's your mission statement to describe your program, describe what your goals are for the next 3 years. How do you know what you do really works? How do you measure it? How do you evaluate it? How is it? What are the concrete measurable ways that anybody could do it? And that is huge. Being able to prove your work in writing to the foundation, then that goes into a pool of other people, other organizations who are most like you because they think they're a match too. So if you're looking for a youth grant, you're competing with other youth-led social justice groups around the country for a very small amount of money. So now you're in competition with groups that would otherwise be your allies. Not that that then makes you not allies. For sure it doesn't, because I think people get the game. But it definitely adds a little bit of something else in that mix. Once you send your proposal, and then there's the site visit, the dreaded site visit, where they fly program officers and board members and allies and who knows what else. We've had sometimes teams of 12 people come into our office to basically say, we read what you wrote, we like what you wrote, but now we want to see it. We want to see your work in person. So it's the kind of dog and pony show where, you know, you basically prep your leadership to say, you're going to have an outside group come in. This is what they're going to want to know. Everybody reads a proposal, and you prep for these folks coming in. You put on a presentation that kind of goes over similarly what you put in the grant, and then they ask you a wide variety of questions that you need to be able to answer. And you have to say that everything you do is perfect, because if you say, you know what, actually, we're having a really hard time building our base. Oh, really? That must mean you can't do your work. Thank you so much. And that's the end of that. So there's a lot of, you know, fronting that everything you do is perfect and couldn't be done better, and you figured out the magic way to organize and do radical work without any glitches. And again, that's really problematic for the movement, because we never know how to stop talking like that, even when we're in a room by ourselves with each other. Because there's always the fear that if you say, actually, we really have not gotten this, or our board is not like that, then the word gets out and then you're no longer credible and then nobody funds you. So there's a way in which we internalize this kind of masking of perfection so that we can get grants that never goes away. So after that site visit, you wait and you find out if you got the grant, and then if you do, you get the check, and then you write a mid-year report on proving that the money that they gave you helped you increase your capacity or work with more girls or expanded your work, and writing reports that are very detailed. And then at the end of the year or the end of your cycle, you write a final report, same thing. That's for one grant. So imagine if you're doing this for 4, 5, 6, 7 foundations to, you know, bring in money for your budget. So, and all of that has an enormous paper trail in terms of what they want. They want budgets. They want a list of board. They want a list of members. They want to know about your meetings. There's so many detailed things that they want to know. And, you know, also a lot of documents that they need, legal documents that they have to have that kind of prove that you are incorporated and official and, you know, and you just can't say, oh, actually, we don't have a fax machine. We don't have a website. We don't have letterhead. We don't have business cards, because then that makes you suspect. Like, why don't you have those things? You must not be a real agency. So there's all these dynamics that played out that, you know, that really just kind of formalize that you are working as an agency. It is not as important. Not that foundations aren't funding grassroots organizing or political work, want to make sure you have a target and a demand and you're running a campaign. But before they would even see that or even give you a check for $50,000, your agency has to be sound. The agency aspect of your work has to be solid. I think some foundations now are a little bit more lenient with that, but you know, especially for large grants money, you know, they want to make sure that you can be trusted with the grant, you know, regardless of the work that you do. So that's kind of walking you through, you know, grant. And even before then, there's all the schmoozing with program officers and relationship building and calling and contacting and setting up meetings. Hey, I'm going to be in D.C. I want to talk to you about our work. Think if it's a match, if you think we should apply. And again, going in and saying, we've got this amazing program. It's flawless. It's perfect. We do everything great. Don't you think we should apply? And so, again, it's really difficult to kind of keep that up all the time and never let that go, to talk about the challenges that we're having in doing this work on the ground. Grassroots fundraising, on the other hand, while there's still you know, some need to say, look, this great innovative program. And we do have innovative programs. That's not the problem. It's just that they aren't always perfect. But grassroots fundraising is basically money that you raise through individual asking people face to face or through letters or through phone calls to make contributions to your work. And also asking for people who are in the communities that you're organizing to support your work. So the girls at Sisters in Action pay dues to be involved in the organization. As leaders, they have to each raise a certain amount of money to be to graduate our advanced leadership program. We have house parties. We sell T-shirts. You know, we come up with major donor campaigns. This is all work that our membership base gets to do, and it's part of their leadership development. Those girls do not write grants. They do not fly to D.C. to meet with program officers. So in terms of even what is a better match to our leadership development program, grassroots fundraising is at the core of our leadership development work, because you have to talk about the work. You are somebody, you know, taking significant leadership in the work, and you're asking folks to support it who live in your neighborhood, who benefit from the new bus passes that got won, you know, who are frustrated with the No Child Left Behind's impact on Jefferson High School. And so grassroots fundraising is a lot of face-to-face work, organizing work that brings in money, smaller amounts, but more committed, no reports, people like updates and letters, but it's not the same kind of institution coming in as outsiders to view and see if you're legitimate or not. These are folks who come to your annual event, who went to your action and saw you like storm into, you know, Fred Hansen's office. And so it's more integrated into the organizing work. And if you didn't have to pay salaries and benefits, you could raise the money that you need for your programming from grassroots fundraising. The largest part of organizational budgets are salaries and benefits that, you know, are 60-70% of people's budgets. But the money it would take for us to rent a place, to provide food, to provide bus passes, to, you know, have the supplies that we need, is like 30-40% of a budget. And you can raise that through grassroots fundraising. And it just means that everybody volunteers, not just your leaders. Everybody does. And everybody figures out how to integrate it in other parts of their lives. I think that there's still a way in which fundraising, there is a level of kind of pretense that you are saying that, you know, what you're doing, you can't talk about flaws so much. But when you build relationships with donors who believe in the mission and who see your work, it is much easier to say, we're having a hard time organizing this year because all of our girls are being pushed out of the neighborhood. And so they're commuting an hour now to get to the office, whereas before it was 2 minutes away from their school. And people are like, I've seen that. That's true. So we need your support to help us really, deal with this challenge. And I think that when you organize and you fundraise, you're building relationships with people who are committed to the organization, who have a much longer, higher threshold for dealing with hard times and challenges in the work, because it's a relationship. It's not much more of an authentic relationship than a foundation as an institution who's based in New York, who comes in one time to see your work. I think the potential for grassroots organizing to be about community organizing and relationship building and sustaining organizations is much, much higher than the relationships we end up building with foundations that when they stop funding you, you never see them again. When you're no longer eligible because you've been funded, once, and they only fund foundations once, how does that build relationships that really sustain the organization? So I think there's always challenges in fundraising in general, but I think the potential for movement building and for sustainability of organizations and for integrating into your organizing work is much, much higher in grassroots fundraising. And the very fact that your leadership base can do grassroots fundraising, to me, demonstrates the connection between organizing for social justice and taking on institutions and organizing allies and supporters and other leaders to fund the work that's going to be, a long time commitment.
You are listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO Portland. Tonight, we are speaking with Amara Perez and Emmy Koyama about the nonprofit industrial complex and its effects on grassroots organizing. Andrea Del Moral wrote about the May 2004 conference, The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, hosted by Insight, in the April 4th, 2005 Lip magazine. She writes, "Charities first gained tax-exempt status because Congress determined that they provided services that the government would otherwise have provided. Since these organizations were saving the government money, it seemed logical to give them a tax break. As this system evolved, however, the work of nonprofits replaced government services to the point that we consider it normal that a hospital depend on foundation grants and that a university depend on wealthy donors. This may be fine. Those institutions may provide their services as well or better than the government would." In the middle of the 20th century, movements for radical social and political transformation, which we currently call social justice movements, got ensnared in this same system. In the beginning, not all these organizations were tax-exempt. Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, which employed many more people than before in the social service sector, influenced the nonprofit sector to become more uniform in methodology and protocol because it was government-sponsored. Then, Ronald Reagan reduced the nonprofit organization to a tax classification, and the economic structure of the nonprofit sector became its most important element. The activities of the nonprofits simply had to somehow benefit the public, but their finances were more strictly regulated. Reagan's corporate favoritism further pushed nonprofits to adopt corporate structure through his narrower definition of a nonprofit organization, which was determined by its financial structure. But it is not the job of social justice movements to replace government functions, except possibly in the broadest sense of creating decentralized and directly democratic structures. The government does not pay itself to agitate against privatization, protest war, hold cops and politicians accountable, keep radical history alive, or defend human rights. Why, then, do social justice organizations join the nonprofit sector, which means they must mimic corporate structure, entrench itself in government regulations, and pander to foundations? This structure has allowed some organizers a stable work environment complete with the corporate benefits of salaries, health care, and retirement plans. But at what cost? For those of us seeking fundamental revolutionary change, the nonprofit glut has cost us our broad-based social movements. The rest of this article can be found at lipmagazine.org. Again, this is Amara Perez.
I hear a lot that people say, if we don't pay people to do the work, who will do the work? And, you know, when I was recently doing a reading, somebody said, you know, how will we get people to do the work if we don't pay them? How will they balance? You know, how do we get people to balance this and really carve out, you know, doing social justice work in their lives? And my response is that I learned that from the girls that I worked with who were at school from 8 in the morning until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, then came to Sisters in Action and spent 4 hours at the office, you know, doing campaign meetings and leadership development and having discussions, and then went home and did their homework and spent time with their families. The reality is that our membership base, our constituency, has already learned how to balance and navigate that balance. And, you know, it wasn't like, you know, during the Cuban Revolution, people were waiting for a Ford grant before they hit the mountains. You know, that this is new. This is new. And the balance has already been, you know, the bulk of our legacy. And I think that part of what's problematic and what comes out in the book is that we've already, in a short amount of time, internalized the belief that we can't do the work unless we get paid to do it, and that we can only get real money if we get grant money. And, grassroots fundraising seems like, oh, who wants to do that? And it seems harder, and it seems disconnected from the organizing work, which is not, it's not, that's not true. That's not what our, you know, past has been. It's been absolutely integrated with the organizing work, and it's part of how we organize people. So I think, you know, being able to chip away at that for people who are my generation of coming into the work, to know that we don't need to get paid to do the work as staff. We don't necessarily need staff. And I'm not saying that across the board. I think that first and foremost, we need to carve out the space in the movement to have a discussion and examination of where we're at and what's working and what's not. And I think that, you know, no individual, no organizations alone can kind of have this conversation. The problem is there's so few spaces for us to come together and have these conversations, since most of the times we come together, it's on a foundation dollar, because they're the ones who are having a conference or a gathering, and we come and it's their agendas, and, you know, they have things that they need to get out of it, which are not always what we could get out of it.
Do you want to talk about maybe the spaces that have been created to talk about it and how this fledgling conversation is going?
Right.
That conversation.
I remember, I think it was 2002 when Insight organized the conference, and the conference was called The Revolution Will Not Be Funded: Beyond the Nonprofit Industrial Complex. And it was an amazing moment, because I think that there were many of us who were having these conversations, but only within the walls of our organizations, because there wasn't really yet a critique about nonprofit. There was more of a kind of a wide acceptance of the structure to do our work. And yet I know for us at Sisters in Action, and then once we got there, a lot of other folks had so many experiences and so many contradictions and challenges that we were grappling with, that it was thrilling that there was a conference that was organized that would really like name those and kind of bring life to them and validate them as something so real, and that it brought it up in a larger political context, that we could see where that was the nonprofit structure really designed to, you know, depoliticize and de-radicalize some of the most, you know, amazing work happening. So when we came, I think there were so many stories that people had brought with them, and it was an amazing time. And I think that people who came, who may not have had the same experiences, could resonate with something, you know. And so from that, I think I would say that was a turning point. And I haven't been in any social justice space since that the issue hasn't been raised in a critical way, and that for the first time, it's not widely accepted without some critique at, like, well, maybe we need to think about this being different. And that's a huge shift. And that was just in a few years. With the book coming out, I think that it kind of more institutionalizes and legitimizes that this is something that's not just a gathering organized by Insight, a group of radical women of color, but that this is something that is really like on everybody's mind, and that people are going to really respond to it in terms of thinking about the ways they're going to do their work and thinking about them differently. And I've been in places now where people are saying, we're going to build, you know, a queer organizing school, and nobody's going to get paid to really be trainers. And nobody's like, wait a minute, you can't do that. You can't, you know, people are like, okay, good, that makes sense, because then we can sustain it, you know. And I think people get that this money is not, that is out there, is not real money, you know. And even if you get a really great big grant, which Sisters in Action did get a lot of really big, great grants, they end someday, you know? And so how will you have your capacity not compromised when those grants stop coming in, or when it's not sexy to fund youth organizing anymore, which is what happened to us? We came in at a time when youth organizing was kind of cutting edge and everybody wanted to fund it. And now people are like, actually, we don't even want to fund grassroots organizing. We want to fund intermediary organizations, large think tanks. We're going to focus all our money on electoral work. We're going to do media stuff, large scale, big capacity, and grassroots fundraising is not getting funded. So now you have grassroots organizations shutting down because they don't have the money to do their work. And that's a shame, because we can do the work without foundations. It's just a matter of shifting our thinking and the culture of the movement at this particular historical, you know, moment to really get ourselves to think differently. So people are thinking differently. What I've seen being built now and discussed to being built now is with the mindset of, okay, so people aren't going to get paid, they're going to volunteer. And I think it raises a lot of, again, questions and people having a lot of fears about what that will mean, because many of us have been, you know, organizers as for careers for a long time. And so that would really shift what we would do during the day. And it would put us in the same role that our membership base and our leaders are in, of working and then in the evening carving out time to do the organizing work, which is reflects the legacy that we come from. And I think that's what we need to hold on to and rely on and trust in and know that this is what we've been doing. It's not new. The 501c3 is new, not getting paid. With the group Happy Hours, the organization that we have for organizing lesbian women of color that we've done for 8 years, everybody volunteers. And when we need money for projects, we organize events and we ask people in the organization to give money. And then if we have the money, we do it. If we don't, we don't do the project. In terms of competition with other organizations, there's something about being kind of under the radar, because we're not a nonprofit. And because we don't, you know, really apply for grant. We've applied for a grant once to get money to buy equipment because we were doing some media documentary work and we were rejected. So there's something about being off the radar that, if anything, it makes it a little harder to for people to see that organization as kind of a viable, legitimate organization. And so I think that, like, when I think about my experience with Sisters in Action or being part of other nonprofits, when you say we're a nonprofit, people are like, ooh, you're a nonprofit. That's, you know, there's a status with that. We've had a lot of people say, with Happy Hours, you should get a 501c3 and you should get a nonprofit. And I think, she's crazy. That's not going to happen. You know, I mean, it's not going to happen. But I think people say that because they want so much for there to be more legitimacy for the group. So we've had people who've come from out of town for events who said, this is such an amazing organization. For Pride, we had 125, you know, women of color come to our cookout at Overlook Park. And I got 3 emails from people saying, this is an amazing event. So great. You really should get your nonprofit thing so you can start getting corporate sponsors for next year. And it was just like, ugh, you know, just like, but, and I know that people are coming from a really good place. They just get excited, and that's the next step for them. And these are not even folks who are necessarily working in nonprofit organizations. So I think what's been harder to do is that when we've met with other organizations and said, here's the group that we are, and this is what we've done, that because we're not a nonprofit and we haven't been kind of sponsored by corporations or sponsored by foundations, they don't necessarily see us as an organization to be reckoned with or an organization to partner with in any formal way. And so, you know, we've had people from other organizations who are saying, like, you know, oh, there's no groups in Portland that are for women of color. And we're like, that's not true. Like, we have, you know, an organization for 8 years that's been doing this work. And because there's no place to find us necessarily on a foundation list or from other corporate sponsors, we're just invisible. And I think that's one of the biggest concerns I have, and that I think a lot of folks have, is if foundations don't fund you, who will see you? How do you get seen in a nonprofit industrial complex movement if that's what gives you credibility and that's what raises you up to be seen by the movement? And I think that that's real. That's really real. And so we haven't gotten to a place where there's kind of a competition. We're still trying to be seen, you know, and we're still trying to have, you know, in the ways that people come and who work with youth say, oh, we need to meet with Sisters in Action because they do this. That hasn't happened to us, even though we've been around for so long and been doing this work and filling a niche that hasn't been filled, because we're just off the radar. It's just, it's a whole different way of interacting.
And do you see this as a movement, as an alternative ways that groups can be seen?
I don't think that the Revolution Will Not Be Funded is a movement. I think it's a movement question.
Right.
I think it's a question that the social justice movement needs to ask each other. I think that what it does is it kind of legitimizes folks being brave enough to try different ways after 30 years of doing it one way, 40 years of doing it one way. I think it provides us an opportunity to think about our work differently. And what it does is give people a little bit more, kind of empowers people to say, no, we're not going to be a nonprofit. We're actually not going to do this. And here's the strategic, radical reasons why we're not. And then that, to me, is what's really powerful, as opposed to, oh, you just don't have your stuff together. That's why you're not. Like, no, we actually think this is really radical, and it speaks to our legacy, and it's sustainable, and we're all volunteering. You know, I remember being at a meeting with some folks from Happy Hours, and a woman had some experience in doing layout, and she was like, I'll help you do layout, and I won't charge you. And one of the leaders of the organization said, all of us volunteer. Like, nobody's getting paid to be here. And this woman was like, really? Like, she just couldn't imagine that we would have this kind of work and nobody got paid to do it. And I remember thinking, that was a turning point for me. What it felt like to be able to say, I don't get paid to organize with this organization. And all of us are on the same page. None of us are getting paid to do this work. And we all are carving out time to meet and to plan and to organize and to do phone calls. That there was something about that that felt so good. I loved organizing at Sisters in Action. Every day felt good organizing there. But I think that it's hard to sustain. It's hard to sustain, and it's hard to grapple with the contradictions that some folks will get paid to organize and some won't. And that I couldn't bring up all girls to have a career in organizing, because there's no way that every girl could become a staff at Sisters in Action. And so I think that's a difficult message to grapple with, is that since all of you can't get paid, only some of you will get paid. And that even holding up the idea that getting paid is at the top, that that's what you strive for. And it's not. And I think about sometimes what Sisters in Action would have been like if everybody had volunteered, and if girls didn't see themselves running out when they just decide they couldn't get paid to do the work, that somehow they had kind of hit the end of the line because we already had enough youth organizers or enough paid interns, that there was always high levels of leadership that were all volunteer-based. And I think that it's true in all organizations where staff get paid and leaders don't, or only so many can be paid and not everybody. I do think that part of the professionalization of the left not only comes with this idea that you can rest when we've won the revolution, like, you know, that part, is that because you're getting paid to do such privileged work in some ways, like, what a great thing to get paid to do radical social justice work, that, you know, you will work yourself like 80, 90 hours a week. And there's an expectation. I think the culture of the left is one that burns people out. I've seen many elders in the movement get sick, and people watch them get sick. And I think that, you know, when everybody's volunteering and nobody's getting paid, there's a little bit more lax around, like, look, I've got to, you know, I'm tired this week, I can't meet, and say, well, look, you know, you're getting paid to do this, you have to be there, that you get to say, I'm tired, I'm not going to make this meeting. And there's no professional boundaries that would force you to go against what your body is saying because you get paid to do the work. I think that the culture of the left, unfortunately, makes you feel this sense of urgency that if we don't get XYZ done today, this week, this month, that somehow everything's going to fall apart. And that's not true. Like, my favorite analogy is that doing social justice work is like sweeping back the tide with a broom. And that's what it feels like a lot. And I don't think it has to feel like that. I think we can play on the beach. I think we can run in and out of the water. I think we can toss our brooms in the ocean and just know that it's not going anywhere. social justice work is not just about where we arrive. It's the process. It's how we arrive where we arrive. It's what we build. It's the relationships we have. It's how we model our political vision for change every single day. Burning out your comrades is not the political vision that I'm working for. I want people to be able to be in love and to be silly and to laugh and to take breaks and have long lunches and eat healthy food and like go home and be with their families and come to the strategizing meetings feeling like whole people. That's the political vision that I want to experience today and this week and this month and as long as I'm doing the work, and not be asked to leave that aside for when we win and then we get to be whole full people. That's not radical.
And that wraps up another edition of Circle A Radio. Thanks to Imi Koyama and Amara Perez for speaking with us. You can hear Imi Koyama, Amara Perez, as well as Alicia Barrera of Insight, Women of Color Against Violence, at In Other Words Books, as they discuss the challenges of doing social justice work in nonprofit structures and strategies to address those challenges. That event will be held on Monday, August 20th at 6:30 p.m. at In Other Words Books, 8 Northeast Killingsworth Avenue in Northeast Portland. The event is a fundraiser for Sisters in Action for Power, a Portland-based organization that builds and strengthens the leadership and organizing skills of low-income women and girls of color. Circle A Radio airs the first and third Wednesday of the month from 6 p.m. till 7 here on KBOO 90.7 FM, your community radio station. You can reach the Circle A Radio Collective at circlearadio@gmail.com. Good night.